All right, so I think you can see why I chose the first 15 verses. I hope you noticed how many times the word wilderness is used here in the first 15 verses, beginning with John. John appeared baptizing in the wilderness. And then, of course, well, before I say this, why do you think John was in the wilderness? I mean, you could say, well, he knew what Isaiah had prophesied, and so he intentionally went out to the wilderness, and that's possible. But why would you expect someone like John, knowing what he's doing, knowing who he is, to be in the wilderness, as opposed to in Jerusalem? Why wouldn't he be there? No, he was a little bit different, wasn't he? He wasn't accepted among the religious elite. They all rejected him. In fact, when the Pharisees came out, he said, "Brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come?" He didn't exactly have a cozy relationship with the power structure there. He was an outsider. He was very much like the one who prefigured him. Who was that? Who was the prophet in the Old Testament that prefigured John the Baptist? Elijah, who was named the troubler of Israel by Ahab. Elijah wasn't welcome in Jerusalem either. Elijah wasn't the one in Samaria with Ahab. He was out in the wilderness because that just kind of fit. It fit the whole, and he's not eating locust and wild honey just because he's eccentric. He's eating that because he's poor. It's all he can afford. There's still people that eat locusts today. It fits the whole makeup of who he was and what he was all about. And so the fact that it was predicted by Isaiah, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, is more to say, here is someone who identifies with you. Israel was going through a wilderness experience. We talked about the exile being a wilderness. The one who is out there is speaking to those who are the rejects. He is speaking to those whom God is calling. And people come out to be baptized by him. Jesus comes out to be baptized by John. And then where is Jesus driven in verse 12? Into the wilderness. Which, how many days is he in the wilderness? Sound familiar? Do you see how all this is just kind of laying over top of Israel's experience? Jesus is the new Israel. In Matthew chapter 2, the quotation from Hosea, "Out of Egypt I've called my son." Jesus is identified as God's son. And Hosea chapter 11, by the way, is talking about how God brought his son, his firstborn, out of Egypt, speaking of Israel. But he's not just talking about Israel. He's also talking about Jesus. All of this lays on top of each other. And that's what we're going to see in Isaiah. As we go through these passages, we're just going to focus on a few chapters in the 40s of Isaiah, where the message of hope is to a people who are suffering because of sin, because of their own sin. They're in this strange land. They're in a place that is not friendly to faith. They worship foreign gods. They have different religious customs, and of course, they're not moral at all. They worship these foreign gods. But the message of hope is someday God is going to turn this wilderness. He's going to bring you out of this land of oppression. It's kind of like they're back in Egypt, and he's going to lead them on a second exodus. He's going to bring them out just like Moses brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. And Jesus, as the new Moses, is going to lead the people to the land flowing with milk and honey. And by the way, just a preview, when we finish this next week, we're going to begin a new series of classes looking at the seventh day rest and how all of that is prefiguring what we enjoy right now, being God's people enjoying what the children of Israel were supposed to inherit when they came into the promised land, but never could fully realize because of sin. Okay, so let's go to Isaiah 40. And this is what was quoted there in Mark chapter 1. Any comments or questions on Mark 1? I know I dominate the discussion normally. Any comments or thoughts on Mark 1 before we go into Isaiah 40? All right, so comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries, in the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Why would you want a nice, smooth highway? Why would the people in this condition, thinking about where they are, again, Isaiah is projecting as if he's speaking to the exiles in person. They're in Babylon. Why would they be interested in a nice, smooth highway? Yeah, they want to get out of here. In fact, we're going to see an exhortation later in Isaiah where they're told to leave Babylon, get out of Babylon. And they're like, what's the quickest way? Where's the biggest, broadest superhighway? They may not have seen a way out. Well, how are they going to get this way? Well, there's going to be a voice in the wilderness. There's going to be someone who will level all the mountains. He'll fill in the valleys. He'll make it a broad, smooth path so that all of us can go out together. What was the barrier to Israel? The Red Sea. They couldn't get past that. They got Egypt on one side, the Red Sea on the other. So what did God do? He opened a way. Well, that's what John the Baptist is doing, is he's leveling, making this a nice, smooth path so that the people can get out of Babylon. They can go on to be where they want to be. All right, so... one more question I had in the outline here. What was the terrain like between Babylon and Jerusalem? This is going to be important for later. But if you were to take a map, I should have put a map up on the screen. Sorry about that. If you were to take a map, the Mediterranean world, and you got Jerusalem over here, you got Judah over here you got Babylon, what's in between there? In fact, people wouldn't take a line and do it straight across the map. That's not the way they would travel. No one would travel directly, right? What they would do is they would go up across what is called the Fertile Plain. They would follow the river all the way over and down. They would go almost north and west, and then eventually they would come south because it was just impossible. You weren't going to survive in that wilderness.
And that's now, how God called Abraham out when he was in Ur of the Chaldeans and took him on the Fertile Crescent around.
That's right. That's exactly the path that Abraham took. That's the path anyone would take. You just could not survive. There was not a camel that could store enough water both for himself and for you to carry you across that barren wasteland. It was a wilderness. Now keep that in mind as we read some of these passages in Isaiah. All right, so the end of the chapter, we're skipping a lot. Verse 27, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. How are they feeling in exile? What does verse 27 indicate about their emotional disposition? What were they feeling? Yeah. We're just exiles here in this barren wasteland, in this wilderness. Where's God? My way is hidden from him. My right is disregarded by him. But what are they promised? Or let me, before that, that's the question in the outline. What are they told about God? He's everlasting. He's the creator. He does not faint. He does not. So it's not that he's just gotten tired of listening to your prayers and he's worn out, or he's having a bad day, or he's asleep, right? That's what Elijah mocked the prophets of Baal. Maybe he's fallen asleep, right? No, God doesn't sleep. He doesn't get weary. He doesn't grow faint. And he knows. It's not that you're in a place that's so dark he can't see you. His understanding is unsearchable. And so what's the promise? He's going to give you power. To him who has no might, he will increase strength. I love to go out here on the soccer field with some of these young guys and watch them run around. They can just do that all day long. I mean, and then they'll get finished with one game, they want to play something else. They can just go and go and go. Even the youth shall get faint. Even the youth can grow weary. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. God is promising his people just a little bit longer. It's going to be okay. I'm on your side. I'm right here. I know what's going on. I am your God, and it's going to be all right. And that's the promise this made to us. 41, the next chapter. Verse 14, fear not, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. I am the one who helps you, declares the Lord. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I make you a threshing sledge, new, sharp, and having teeth. You shall thresh the mountains and crush them. You shall make the hills like chaff. You shall winnow them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the tempest shall shatter them, and you shall rejoice in the Lord, and the Holy One of Israel you shall glory. What's their emotional makeup according to verse 14? What are they feeling? Yeah. Like they're small, like they're nothing. What else does he say that suggests something about how they're feeling? Yeah. They're afraid. What are they afraid of? What's intimidating to them right now in Babylon? Let me ask it this way. When the prophets, and of course, you notice that Isaiah, for most of the book, writes in poetic format, which means this is not just a narrative, this is to be read like a poem, right? So this is figurative language. When the prophets talk about mountains and hills, they're usually not talking about topography, right? And even in Isaiah 40, where we read that the voice of the one crying in the wilderness is going to level out the hills and the mountains and fill in the valleys, he's not talking about just what's in between Babylon and Jerusalem, right? What are they talking about when they talk about mountains and hills?
Obstacles.
And I would suggest to you that that's what Jesus said to his disciples when he says, if you have faith, even as a mustard seed, what can you say to this mountain? Be removed and thrown into the sea. That's what Jesus is talking. He's talking about obstacles, obstacles to the kingdom. Have faith in God, because God can remove mountains. What are the mountains standing between them and going home? What's the biggest mountain standing in their way? Yeah, it's Babylon. That's what they're afraid of. That's what the Israelites were afraid of when they were in Egypt. They were oppressed by Pharaoh. They couldn't go home. Pharaoh was their master. They couldn't overcome his chariots. And yet, with the power of God, they could. God delivered them. God leveled that mountain in Pharaoh. And he was going to level Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. They had nothing to fear. He says, in fact, I'm going to make you a threshing sledge. You're going to winnow, and you're going to thresh the mountains. Imagine an implement of iron that could thresh a whole mountain and tear it up. You're going to winnow them, and the wind shall carry them away. There won't be found anything of the remnants of Babylon when you get done with them. I'm going to make you an army that's going to overcome the enemy, and you're going to rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. Verse 17, when the poor and needy seek water and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, and the olive. I will set in the desert the cypress, the plane, and the pine together, that they may see and know, may consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord has done this, the Holy One of Israel has created it. What was one of the biggest problems or one of the biggest complaints by God's people in the wilderness? What did they not have? Water. They didn't have water because they were in a wilderness. And that's the reason God brought them into the wilderness, so that they might learn to trust that if they just come to God and pray, He can bring water out of rock. That's what our God can do. Our God is not limited in any way. There is no wilderness that can overcome you. And He's going to change this wilderness. And there's different ways you could see this wilderness, because what happened to the land when the people left it? The promised land, the land that was flowing with milk and honey. What did God say He was going to do to that land if they didn't keep the covenant? Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28. What did God say was going to be the curses on the land? Exactly. That land that was flowing with milk and honey, eventually the animals would take over. And whenever the animals come in, when the prophets talk about the porcupine and the ostrich and, you know, all these animals just come, that means that it's not inhabitable by man anymore. It means that He has taken this land that was so beautiful. And think about it, this is like the original picture in the garden, right? What happened to the garden? God cursed the land. When Cain sinned, we talked about that in one of the first lessons. When Cain sinned, he cursed the land because of Cain's sake. The land always gets it. And I've used this analogy before. It's kind of like the Lion King when the hyenas move in. The land just becomes desolate, right? But when the king takes his rightful place over the kingdom, well, then everything becomes lush and green again. And that's the pictures that Isaiah and other prophets are giving, is that I'm going to turn this barren wasteland, a barren wasteland because of your actions, because of your sin. There's a direct line drawn between the lack of water, the lack of rain, the fields that have just been burned up. There's a direct line God draws between their sin and what's happening to the land. But God's going to bring you back, and He's going to make this land abundant and fruitful again, opening rivers, fountains in the midst of the valleys, the wilderness a pool of water, dry land springs of water. I mean, does this sound like Jesus, anybody? I mean, does this sound familiar? Does Jesus use this kind of language speaking about Himself and what He has come to do? I will give you rivers of living water. You can drink of this well and you're going to be thirsty again, but if you take what I have to offer, you'll never thirst again. You'll never be hungry again. I am the bread of life. This is what we've been looking at in the Gospel of John, doing the 40-day challenge. I mean, all of this imagery is picked up by Jesus as He interprets what He is doing in His ministry. Okay, so thoughts or comments on this before we got a lot more to look at. All right, so yes. Yeah, yeah. You're not going to have a cypress in a desert, are you? Some plants grow in a desert, but not many. Not many. That is an amazing thing when you go to the wilderness to see all these plants that can survive on like one inch of rain a year or something like that. Amazing. But Most plants can't. And of course, humans have a really hard time in that kind of environment. Any other comments? All right, so 42. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law. Are the people deprived of justice in Babylon? Absolutely. They're not seeing justice. And yet, what is God's servant going to bring the nations? He's going to bring justice to the nations, and he's going to bring it to his people. That's what the people are longing for, and that's what is necessary for the land to be blessed. If the nation is ruled by tyrants, if they're ruled by the Lion King analogy, the hyenas who are just there to abuse and to take and to consume, and that's what the land has to put up with, we see what happens. We see it in our world. That's the nature of Babylon. That's why Babylon eventually always caves in on itself, because it's not ruled by justice and righteousness. But the servant of the Lord, he's going to bring true justice. So 42 and verse 14, skipping down. For a long time I have held my peace. I have kept still and restrained myself. Now I will cry out like a woman in labor. I will gasp and pant. I will lay waste mountains and hills and dry up all their vegetation. I will turn the rivers into islands and dry up the pools. And I will lead the blind in a way that they do not know. In paths that they have not known, I will guide them. I will turn the darkness before them into light, the rough places into level ground. These are the things I do, and I do not forsake them. There's a contrast in fates here. What's going to happen to those who are rich and powerful and who are enjoying the good life right now? All of that's going to change. God has the ability not only to make the wilderness fruitful and abundant, he can take an abundant land and make it a wilderness, and that's what he's going to do. But what's he going to do for the blind? He's going to lead the blind. He's going to guide them, turning darkness into light, rough places into level ground. And we see all that prefiguring the ministry of Jesus and the fact that he didn't go to the rich and the powerful. He went primarily to the poor, to those who were the outsiders, to those who were literally blind in some cases, giving them sight. Chapter 43. But now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I give Egypt as your ransom, Cush and Seba in exchange for you, because you are precious in my eyes and honored, and I love you. I give men in return for you, peoples in exchange for your life. Fear not, for I am with you. I will bring your offspring from the east, and from the west I will gather you. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the end of the earth, everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. The theme, I think, of all of these chapters is the fact that God is going. And what does the word redeem mean? Anybody? It means to buy back. They are slaves. They're in bondage. And God is going to come and redeem them. He's going to release them from this bondage. He's going to give other peoples in exchange for them. Verse 4. Even speaking about Egypt and Cush and Seba. This is all metaphor, right? He's just saying, I'm going to bring you out. You are not abandoned. You are not forgotten. I know you. I love you. I've called you by my name. I made you for my glory, and I'm going to bring you out, and I'm going to give you this land again. I'm going to bring you out of this exile and this wilderness that you're in, bringing them from the east and the west and the south and the north. All right, and then verse 14 and 43. Thus says the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, for your sake I send to Babylon and bring them all down as fugitives, even the Chaldeans, in the ships in which they rejoice. I am the Lord, your Holy One, the Creator of Israel, your King. Thus says the Lord, who makes a way in the sea, a path in the mighty waters, who brings forth chariot and horse, army and warrior. They lie down, they cannot rise. They are extinguished, quenched like a wick. Remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? I make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. The wild beasts will honor me, the jackals and the ostriches, for I give water in the wilderness, rivers in the desert, to give drink to my chosen people, the people whom I formed for myself, that they might declare my praise. Does any of this sound familiar? What are some words or phrases here that would make them think about what Moses did for them, bringing them out of Egypt? Yeah, a way in the sea, just like they passed through the Red Sea. What else? Yeah, the chariot and the horse, the army and the warrior, they lie down, cannot arise, they're extinguished. And when he says in verse 18, remember not the former things. I think that this is said somewhere else in Isaiah as well. When he says remember not the former things, because I'm going to do a new thing, he's contrasting what God did with Moses with what he's going to do with his servant. And saying, you're going to forget all about what happened with the Exodus. Every year they had the Passover to remind them of God's great deliverance. But there's going to come a day where you're going to forget about that. That's going to be nothing, right? You're not going to be talking about that Exodus, because this new thing is going to be so much greater. And he'll say later, I'm going to give you a new song. The song that Moses sang, the song of Moses, the song of deliverance in Exodus 15, you're not going to be singing that song anymore. You're going to be singing a new song. I'm going to give you a new name, doing this new thing. What he's picturing is this second Exodus, bringing them through the wilderness, doing a new thing, making a way in the wilderness, rivers in the desert, and so on. Thoughts or comments on that? All right, we may not cover all the rest of these passages in Isaiah, but let's look at 48 next. Yes.
Oh, you're talking about, I think, 42, 1 through 4. Sorry, I'm a little late.
No, that's cool.
About them not having justice in Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's going to deliver them from that.
Right.
But if you reflect back to the first part of this book, they didn't have justice in Judah either. And
that's right. That's right. In chapter 1 of Isaiah, he talks about how the city of Jerusalem was filled with injustice. But at the end of Isaiah, you see the promise of a new Jerusalem, a place that will be ruled by justice and righteousness. Good thoughts. Any other comments? Okay, 48 and verse 20. Go out from Babylon. Flee from Chaldea. Declare this with a shout of joy. Proclaim it. Send it to the end of the earth. Say, the Lord has redeemed his servant Jacob. They did not thirst when he led them through the deserts. He made water flow for them from the rock. He split the rock and water gushed out. There is no peace, says the Lord, for the wicked. And this is not only, this imagery and this language is not only picked up by Jesus in the Gospels, we see it in Revelation. When a new Babylon is presented here, this great city, this pompous, prideful city that tramples those that oppose it, that commit adulteries with all the nations, speaking of the economic ties that they have with others and alliances and treaties, God's going to bring Babylon down, and he says to his people, get out of her. He's not saying to change their address. They're still living in the same place. What does he mean when he says to the early Christians living in Asia Minor, what does he mean, get out of Babylon? Is he saying move from Ephesus or move from Laodicea? What is he telling them to do? Get out of Babylon. Yeah, this is not your world anymore. Do like Daniel did. Open your windows to Jerusalem. Pray 3 times a day if you need to. Remind yourself that you don't belong here. So don't be engaged in the idolatries and the immorality that's all around you. That's what he means when he says to flee from Babylon. It's a spiritual exodus, you could say. All right. Yeah. All right, so we're going to stop there in Isaiah. And I feel so bad. There is no Matthew 6, verse 30 through 52. The application to this lesson, I meant Mark 6. So look over at Mark 6, verse 30 through 52. And I'm just going to summarize. You know these stories. In the first paragraph, verses 30 through 44, Jesus feeds the 5,000. And He's wanting to get his disciples away by themselves, but when he sees the crowds, he sees them as sheep not having a shepherd. And he has compassion on the multitudes. And he tells the disciples, you give them something to eat. And they say, we only have 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus says, feed them. And so they go out. You can just imagine Peter and Andrew, each with a basket, you know, like, pinch off just a little bit, you know, please don't take too much, you know, but like they're just going out there among the crowds and everyone is fed. In the context of what we've been talking about, Isaiah, thinking about the second Exodus, what is the lesson Jesus trying to teach his disciples and us? Are you going to starve in the wilderness? No, not when you have the bread of life. He's here. He's with us. He's going to take care of us. It's all going to be okay. He knows, he cares, and he is more than able to satisfy all of our needs. And John chapter 6 makes it clear that the bread he's talking about is not physical bread. It's the bread of life. And then verses 45, the second part of this, down to verse 52, Jesus goes up and starts praying as he often did. His disciples go out there on the boat. They're straining in the winds and the waves. And what does Jesus do? He comes to them, walking on the water. What's their initial reaction? Fear. Think about Isaiah. Were the people afraid of the waters in Isaiah? But Isaiah 43, you don't need to be afraid of the waters. The waters are not going to overwhelm you. The fire is not going to burn you. You're going to be okay because I love you. I am right there with you. I have called you by name. You are mine. I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to protect you. And that's the lesson here as well. Do not be afraid. And Jesus stills the waters. That's all meant for us. We're supposed to see ourselves in this wilderness where there's a scarcity of bread and water, where there's a lot of terrifying things, choppy waters, storms that come up unexpectedly. And the point we're supposed to take from Isaiah is that we have the servant of the Lord who is leading us through this barren wasteland. It's all going to be okay because he's with us. Thoughts or comments on that? Yes.
Jesus walking on the water. The interesting thing is, you know, Israel and really humans, we
I used to study with this lady that she had such tremendous faith, and she's been through a lot of trials in her life. And we were studying one time, and she said, David, I was going through this trial in my life, and I started praying that God would deliver me from this trial. And then she said, I remembered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and I remembered Daniel. God didn't save them from the fiery furnace. God didn't save them from the lion's den. He saved them through the fiery furnace, through the lion's den. And she said, it was at that point that I changed my prayers. Help me get through this, not just take it away. And I think that should be our prayer in the wilderness. The wilderness serves a purpose. That's what we've been trying to establish. It teaches us humility. It teaches us dependence. It teaches us faith. And so going through a wilderness is not a terrible thing, not for a child of God. It's a loving father disciplining his children, Deuteronomy 8, teaching us, training us what we need. All right, thank you.